Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of New Books in General History. I'm one of the hosts on the channel, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I am very excited today to be speaking to Dr. Joe Fewsmith about his book, Forging Leninism in China, Mao and the Remaking of the Chinese Communist Party, 1927 to 1934, which is published by Cambridge University Press now in 2022. The book is a re-examination of the events of the Chinese Revolution and the transformation of the Chinese Communist Party in this very important time period of 1927 to 1934. Dr. Fewsmith offers an analysis of the development of the party that really gives insight not just into events that were happening at the time, but also helping us understand the Chinese Communist Party as it then developed and kind of giving us some insight that maybe helps us understand where it came from and how it ended up maybe in quite a different place as his book describes. So I'm very interested today to learn more about his work and obviously share it with the listeners who presumably have not yet had the privilege of reading his book. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Fewsmith.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Melcher.
If we could start off, please, with you maybe introducing yourself a bit, your academic background, and explain how you came to write this book.
Well, thank you. Academic background, I studied at the University of Chicago, received my PhD in 1980, so it's been quite a while since then. And I've been now at Boston University teaching about China for 30 years? And I work primarily on contemporary domestic politics. Contemporary can be a bit ambiguous because I've started writing on this, I guess, in the 90s, and have been doing that for 30 years. So the definition of contemporary has changed over 30 years. But in any case, one of the things that I never really got in my graduate work or early academic work was the history of the Chinese Communist Party, which is enormously important even to this day. And, you know, I'd had this question in my mind about something known as the Futian incident or Futian uprising, Futian being the name of a town in Jiangxi province. And this is something that's fairly well known, but not well understood. And I started reading about it. I started asking some questions about it. And sort of one question led to another question, led to another question. So it was really a lot of fun to do this. I just learned an enormous amount about the development of the Chinese Communist Party in this period and through sort of an expansive look at this one incident. So I think I'll stop that general description there, and we can start exploring that.
Yes, please. Let us start exploring that, and perhaps start with the early part of the book, kind of setting the stage for this incident, for this development, and looking a little bit earlier at the United Front, right, which is the I'm sure you can explain it better than I can, but the sort of agreement between the Kuomintang and the Chinese Communist Party in the 1920s to not fight each other too much or entirely. I mean, technically, it was probably more of a truce than that, but was it practically? But anyway, you describe at the beginning of your book the violent breakup of the First United Front in 1927, and that the CCP had a whole bunch of different responses to it. There were a number of kind of splinters that developed. So could you set the stage for us a little bit about this violent breakup and then explain how the CCP splintered in response?
Sure. As you said, the Kuomintang and the old Nationalist Party and the Chinese Communist Party, which is a much newer, maybe more youth-oriented, more ideological, more disciplined party, had formed a united front under Sun Yat-sen's leadership. Sun Yat-sen, of course, died shortly thereafter in 1925. And the Kuomintang part of this arrangement was subsequently led by Chiang Kai-shek, who was a military leader. And he leads what's called the Northern Expedition. The movement was then based in South China in the city of Guangzhou. And they took off from there, heading towards central China. And as the expedition went on, and in the immediate aftermath of Sun Yat-sen's death, tensions developed between the Kuomintang part and the Chinese Communist Party, the CCC part. And the CCP basically heads to Wuhan in the central China, sets up their own political apparatus there, and increasingly tries to corral, control Chiang Kai-shek. Chiang Kai-shek sets up his military headquarters in the city of Nanchang in Jiangxi province, and from there launches an expedition to Shanghai. After taking the city of Shanghai, I would say with communist support and help in that, Chiang Kai-shek suddenly turns on the Chinese Communist Party in April 12th, 1927. And that mostly night, there were some 500 or so communist leaders who were killed. Another 1,000 or so disappeared. And the party was really broken up. This was usually described as a coup d'etat. And it was. It was a very violent split of what had been a united front. The Chinese Communist Party then has to decide what to do. You look back at this and you think, well, gee, if a powerful military force had turned on me, I would go into hiding. I would rethink my strategy. I'd try to develop some military strength and maybe fight another day. This is not what they did. They had a critical meeting on April the 7th, 1927, and you have another leader from the Comintern, a man by the name of Beso Lomanadze, come down to Wuhan where they held the meeting. And, of course, he calls Chen Duxiu, the leader of the Chinese Communist Party up until that point. He calls him a rightist opportunist. This is the first time that the Chinese Communist Party has used labels like that to label their political enemies. This is getting close to the notion of a politically correct line. At any case, they decide that what they need to do at that point is to launch a revolution. Not that they hadn't had one, but to continue that because the model here is really the Russian Revolution. The Russian Revolution, you recall, failed in February, and then went on to success in November. And so they're thinking, well, we launch a bunch of small revolutions, uprisings, really, and then they can very quickly converge on the cities, and lo and behold, we'll be in power in no time. Chu Chou-bai, who becomes the leader of the Chinese Communist Party at this time, says, okay, party members, return to your home villages and start these uprisings. And so the party scatters. And the interesting thing is there's very little central power here. The party's center it doesn't really have resources to disperse. And so all these different parts of the party really don't have this sense of hierarchy and discipline, or even really a sense of mission other than violence. The violent aspect of this is really quite extraordinary. Chucho Bai is calling for red terrorism. They're talking about the slaughter of all landlords, big and small. There's a real element of violence here. And so these people go back to their villages, and they're under a lot of pressure to launch revolutions, rebellions, and they do so, but they're not really, they don't have a sense of strategy. So you can gather a bunch of peasants, go into the county town, and you usually get slaughtered because the county town has military forces or police forces that are simply much stronger. And so you've lost this sense of hierarchy and of discipline. And some of these Communist Party units actually just simply go into banditry. And so the sense of discipline that had been built up between 1921 and 1927 really does disappear at this point. Is that answer your question?
Yeah, that does. And I love that you kind of framed it as some other people just run and hide, because that is kind of the obvious assumption when you read these accounts of that coup. And it's interesting to sort of see how it develops. So you, in the book, outline this splintering and then sort of focus at first on one of these aspects, the Donggu communist movement.
Right.
Can you tell us about kind of how it developed and what about its method of development made it successful?
Yeah. Your listeners are certainly not going to know the name Donggu. Donggu is the name of a township in eastern Ji'an County in Jiangxi Province. It certainly plays no prominent role in any textbook. There are a few references to it in some of the specialized literature, but very few. It certainly has never played a central role in any of the storytelling, and it really should play a more important role. The Donggu Revolutionary Base Area was created by a number of young communist activists in that township, and I think it's really interesting who these people were, because these are the sons, and they were just, this is all male-oriented, just the sons of, it's hard to say the local elite, but the local, better off than most of society. Donggu itself, the reason I hesitate to use the term elite is because Donggu itself is an area that rents land from a different town, actually Futian, which we will get back to later. And so these are not landlords themselves. They're not rich, although some of them are a little wealthier than others. And the leaders of these people have all gone to school, a normal school in the city of Ji'an, which means that their parents were able to support them enough to send them to school. So these are educated elites, local elites, which, you know, they grow up in this rural township, and it's really a very secluded place, which is one of the secrets of its longevity, is that it's pretty hard to get into this place. It's surrounded by mountains, and so, as they say, that it's easy to defend and hard to attack. But these are people who, when they leave Donggu and develop these outside connections at school, they become radicalized. We're in the wake of the May 4th movement, the May 30th movement, the Northern Expedition. And so they are converted to the idea that what China really needs is a revolution, land reform, you know, to kill some of the landlords, maybe a lot of them. And what holds them together is their elite status. And I say elite status based on where they come from. In that context, they're elite. And in a broader country context, they're not elite at all. And they're very uncertain about their own careers, where they're going to go. You know, when China abolished the examination system back in 1905, they really took down the ladder of success. Where do these young people go? And do you study Chinese learning, Western learning? It's very confused at this time, and they are become dedicated revolutionaries. So they go back to Donggu, and they set up a party cell of the Chinese Communist Party, and that becomes their organization. They will then, because they're classmates, they all get along very well with each other, which is something that other places didn't have. Another thing that other places didn't have is they happen to have been related, family related, to the local bandits. A lot of rural areas in hillside Jiangxi, hill country, you seem to have bandits in every place. And, you know, they, as I say, they were related, they knew each other, and they work out an alliance with the local bandits gang. It's not very big, it's not very powerful, but it gives them some muscle. So they now have a military wing, if you will, and they have a political wing, and they can come together, and because they know each other, they're from the same area, they identify with the local culture, they will be able to hang together much better than other groups that are set up in other villages. This will expand because the original leader of this group, a man by the name of Lai Jingbang, he's killed in one of their early raids. And so the leadership is taken over by another man by the name of Li Wenlin. And Li Wenlin is of a different order. He is well-educated. The point is, these are sons of relatively wealthy people. These are not peasants. Li Wenlin has been to school in Nanchang, he actually went to the Whampoa Military Academy, so he has military training. He participated in the Northern Expedition, and he even participated in the Nanchang Uprising, which is the uprising which the Communist Party claims was the origin of the Red Army. So this is a guy that has good education, good family background, the social connections that come with it, and he's able to take over this Donggu movement and will begin to expand its military wing, and will, you know, it will occupy an area around Donggu and surrounding counties, covering roughly 23 townships. So this is not a small movement. It's pretty large, and as I say, it sticks together in a way that other places didn't. And it sticks together because of the solidarity of this leadership group, their relationship with the original bandits, and because Donggu is physically isolated and, you know, not easy to attack.
Got it. Thank you for explaining the kind of multiple aspects of it, right? That it has to do with, in some ways, terrain, in some ways, education. But it was really interesting how clearly it came through in the book, and again, in your answer just now, the ties as well between the different people really kind of is something that in some ways, it doesn't sound like it was the Donggu movement was the only splinter movement that had that, but it definitely sets itself up as being quite different than some of the other splinters. But now that we've kind of built this up, and you've explained what it was and why it worked, unfortunately, we do now have to reveal, spoiler alert for something that happened decades before, that the Donggu movement was in fact suppressed.
Right.
How and why?
Well, this is a bit of a complicated story, but with the patience of your listeners, I'll try to explain this. As I think everybody knows, Mao Zedong went off to Jing'an Shan. Mao Zedong always had a theory of building up the military. One of the things that I should have noted when I was talking about Chu Zhoubai and the leadership there is that they did not value a military, probably because the party had been manhandled by militaries before, whether it's warlord or the Chiang Kai-shek militaries. They were very idealistic. They thought if they went out and aroused the peasants would rise up and overthrow the ruling powers that were there. And, you know, some people, including Mao, said, no, the way you gain power is to build up a military and head up to the mountains for a while. And he was actually criticized by the Politburo of the Chinese Communist Party for relying too much on the military. Well, he went up to Jing'an Shan and he built his military with the help of Zhu De, of course. And ultimately, it didn't work. In part, it was because another revolutionary by the name of Peng Dehuai came up to Jing'an Shan in the winter of 1928-29. And all of a sudden, there were just too many people to feed. So they said, Peng, why don't you stay here and hold the base area? Zhu De and I will take most of the troops, our troops, and we'll leave and we'll, set off on some guerrilla warfare around Jiangxi. Their army was followed, harassed, in very great danger. And they come to Donggu after some weeks of marching and fighting. And the military, Mao's Red Army, such as it was nearly destroyed at that point. And they spent a week in Donggu, and everybody was happy. The exchange of gifts and all this sort of stuff. And Mao said, you know, if we hadn't had that week in Donggu, the Red Army simply would not have survived. Well, at this time, after a week, Kuomintang armies are beginning to converge, and Mao leaves the Donggu area, or the Donggu area itself probably would have been destroyed. At any case, about a year later, Mao comes back to the area. He's a little bit stronger at this point, and he sets up a base area, if you will, very near Futian, in a little town near that. At any case, they hold this meeting on February 7th, 1930. And this is really one of the critical turning points in the development of the early Communist Party. And it's what Mao does is he begins to incorporate other armies into his own army. So Peng Dehuai's army is incorporated into the Red Army, another army, especially what was called the Sixth Army, which is formed out of local troops. This is when Mao begins to try to take over the armies that have grown up in Donggu and other places and incorporate them into his own army. He incorporates them into his own army. And, this is when the so-called General Front. He's been in charge of a front committee. Now it's a general front committee. In other words, he takes command of all these local forces and his own forces. And this is without authorization of the party center in Shanghai. And so he's just taking over. The other thing that is done there is there's a decision there that says, you know, the local party committees are all dominated by landlords and rich peasants. And we need to get rid of those landlords and rich peasants because they're just following an opportunist line. Well, landlords and rich peasants were the type of people that led local movements like that in Donggu. So what he's really doing is trying to get rid of the local elite. And, you know, he wants to arouse the peasantry. That never quite works, but he does want to get rid of this local elite. The other issue is that he wants to fight a battle by luring the enemy in deep. If you've studied the revolution at all, this is one of those phrases that says, you know, lure the enemy in deep, and it's great guerrilla tactics, and win the battles that way. Well, luring the enemy in deep is not such a good idea if you're luring them into your own hometown. And that's what Mao was advocating. And so Li Wenlin, the leader of the Donggu movement at that time, really argues with Mao. And they, you know, this builds up, and Mao is very frustrated. Li Wenlin is not the only person in Donggu and that area that just doesn't like this idea. So the Red Armies retreat to an area near Donggu, and need to insert one other thing, is that about 3 months after this meeting in February, all of a sudden, in one of the party headquarters, they discover members of the so-called AB clique. Well, the AB clique, AB stands for anti-Bolshevik. There had been an AB clique in Jiangxi in 1927, but it was completely eliminated in the period following that. So somebody says, well, okay, they've revived. They're infiltrating the Chinese Communist Party. And so they begin to arrest people. And when you arrest somebody and you say, are you a member of the AB clique? He says, no. Well, you twist his arm. Maybe you twist it pretty hard. And eventually, if you apply enough pressure and enough pain, and they became very good at applying pain, eventually the guy breaks down and says, yes, yes, I'm a member of the AB clique. Just let me die. And they say, well, you have to reveal the names of other people. So you automatically name people that you know. And so then they go out and arrest those people and apply similar hard methods to them. What is coming out of this, and it develops very slowly, and people like Li Wenlin seem quite oblivious to it at first. They you know, you're in a wartime situation. They become paranoid. They think, well, the Kuomintang really is infiltrating the Communist Party by sending these AB clique people in there. And so, but the bottom line is that the locals are the ones who always end up as members of the so-called AB Tuan, AB clique. And so the tensions between Mao's outsiders, remember Mao is from Hunan, these people are Jiangxi local, and the distinction between local and outsider is a very real distinction in that period of time. The tensions between these groups becomes palpable. Would you like me to continue on into the Futian incident, or?
Yes, please.
Okay. The Futian incident is the one that has gotten the most attention. But in the suppression of the AB Tuan, what should get more attention is that there is there's a suppression of revolutionary, of AB clique people in the Red Army itself. The armies turn on some of their own people, and they probably kill about 1,500 people. This is bloody. They take people out, and you know, it's one of these situations where, you know, if you don't accuse somebody else of being in the AB clique, you're likely to be accused of being in the AB clique. And having done this extermination of groups, they move on to this town of Futian, which, by the way, is a very lovely town built in the Ming Dynasty. But this is where the local leaders of the Donggu Revolutionary Movement have set up their headquarters. Li Wenlin is there, and so, well, actually, Li Wenlin himself is not there, but all of his leadership is there. And Mao sends one of his assistants over there to arrest these people and accuse them of being AB clique members. And so he goes over there and rounds up probably 60 or 70 people, ties them up, starts whipping them and whatever other measures. And, you know, one person is accused of being AB Tuan, AB clique. He's arrested, but then he convinces the person who arrested him, there's someone from the same hometown, that he's not AB clique, and he lets him go. And so he, the next morning, runs over to Futian and frees these people. And, they then write a report to Shanghai. They rebel. They rebel. They say, we're not members of the AB clique. They rebel. And, the bottom line here is that Shanghai, Party Center, will send a group out to Donggu, and they will take every member of the of a particular army. It's called the 20th Army. Every officer from the platoon level up, 700 or 800 people are taken out and shot. So that ends the Futian Rebellion, Futian Incident, which was really, as I say, this is ultimately a conflict between local forces and outside forces. Later documentation, I think, has proven beyond a doubt that there were no members of the AB group in this area. A PLA officer by the name of Xiao Ke, General Xiao Ke, says that he talked to both Communist Party intelligence and Kuomintang intelligence and verified that in this area there were, or other areas, there simply were no AB clique people. This was something that was made up, that was widely believed, and was used to exact terrible violence on the Chinese Communist Party itself. And so you get this clash between outsiders and insiders, locals, that results in this terrible violence. And this will not end the violence. It's carried on into the Central Soviet that will be established shortly after these incidents.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I think I've
so tell us then about kind of the political side, right? We now it's very clear kind of the violent picture of it and the insider outsider conception is really helpful. But you then go on to talk about kind of the violence obviously has an impact on how the CCP moves forward, right? Splinters are essentially being eradicated. But then you also talk about some of the kind of political aspects of it, specifically a meeting on February 7th of 1930.
Oh, no, I talked about the February 7th meeting before. I'm sorry, that was the meeting that incorporated Peng Dehuai's troops into Mao's troops and that he took over there.
Why was this decision so significant?
Well, because Mao is aggrandizing his own power without any authority from party headquarters in Shanghai. He's simply incorporating Peng Dehuai's army, this other Sixth Army that is local troops, and saying, you all listen to me. And he had no authority to do that. It's setting up a much more hierarchical party. And this will be the meeting that ultimately will lead to the launching of the suppression of the so-called AB group.
Hmm. Thank you for kind of clarifying that, because I think it is an important aspect.
It's a critical meeting.
So what then, we've got this critical meeting, we've got the kind of violence, we've got the suppression of the insiders by the outsiders, or the locals by the outsiders. What were the consequences of this violence within the CCP in the longer term?
Well, for the Jiangxi Soviet period, I think the consequences are that it set up sort of a model of violence. In the Jiangxi Soviet period, you set up something called the Political Protection Bureau, which is really your secret police. And their job was really twofold, was to go out and collect money because they were short of resources, and to find people who allegedly belonged to this AB group. And these people were remarkably uncontrolled by higher authorities. They really were, if you headed one of these groups, you were really in charge. And given the violence, the atmosphere of the time, if you didn't go out and find people who were allegedly AB people, then you must be AB people. Well, given this atmosphere, this unleashes a tremendous amount of violence. And of course, as you're going out through the countryside, as I say, the other job was to collect money. You call a meeting of the local peasants, and you ask for money. They say they don't have any, and you say, "Well, are you a member of the AB group? Oh, in that case, I can find some loose change." The atmosphere was just tremendously oppressive. Often they were in charge of recruiting peasants to join the Red Army. No peasant wanted to join the Red Army. I think this is one of the real misunderstandings of the revolution. We often think of it as a peasant revolution. Peasants did not voluntarily join the Red Army because they didn't want to leave whatever land they had, especially if they were the beneficiaries of land distribution. They just want to cultivate the land. They don't want to go and join the military. Their wives don't want them to go because you might get killed. And so there was tremendous resistance to joining the Red Army. If you're joining a militia that defends your hometown, that's one thing. If you're joining the Red Army that's going to go fight in other counties, you want no part of that. And so the party often employed deceptive techniques like, we just need you to come up here and help us for a couple of days. You're not joining the Red Army. Well, you were joining the Red Army, whether you wanted to or not. So there were a lot of defections from the Red Army as people felt coerced or tricked into joining the army, and then they would leave. So it's really hard to depict this as any sort of bottom-up revolutionary movement.
And yet you argue in the book that Mao's ultimately successful taking over in the countryside was only possible because first there were local efforts, such as you described earlier in Donggu. So yeah. How do we understand the kind of why was it that the local had to come first, even if, as you said, there were these pretty strong tensions when it came to recruiting those in the countryside?
I think that's a really good question, which I've pondered. And I think that what it is that people like Li Wenlin and those around him and local activists they really took over their own local society. They're the ones who really broke down the clan-based social order that was in that area. They talked in terms, revolutionary terms. They talked about Marxist ideology. And these were the new elite, if you will. And so they broke down the old order, created an incomplete new order. And in this way, I think they really opened the door for Mao to be able to penetrate more deeply into the countryside. One thing that the Chinese Communist Party was very good at doing, even in this early period, was organizing peasants. That when they controlled an area, they gave everybody a job. It might be something as simple as joining a song group so that you would get village women out of the house, which is very non-traditional, and they would join this group, and you could get together once a week or whatever and sing revolutionary songs. Well, among other things, this makes it very difficult for any woman in the village to say, no, I don't want to sing. What? Are you not, don't support the revolution? Oh, of course I support the revolution. Well, then come on. So you incorporate everybody into these sorts of organizations and give everybody a job. And it's a remarkable story about organization. But I don't think you could have done this without the real breaking up of rural society prior to that.
That makes a lot of sense. And it's very evocative, the idea of a singing group and kind of how that changes what people feel able to say yes and no to. So thank you for kind of explaining what looks like a contradiction, but actually makes sense in terms of kind of breaking down social structure and making changes. So to sort of continue this idea of taking a kind of overview of this time period, right? The book covers 1927 to 1934, which maybe sounds like not that many years, but actually, as you've detailed, a lot is happening. So can you sort of give us an overview? What would you say were the main ways in which the CCP was one thing in 1927 and then very different in 1934? What are the main changes we see?
I think that's the critical question, because obviously the Communist Party was driven out of Jiangxi in 1934, set off on the Long March. But it was a very different party than what had been there in 1927. First of all, it's now really a militarized organization. If Chu Chobai and so forth had opposed the militarization of the Chinese Communist Party in 1927, now it was completely militarized. The military was the backbone of the Chinese Communist Party. Second, the splintering. There's no splintering now. You're either part of a group and a base area, and there were other base areas, I want to make clear, but you don't have the sort of township or village uprising happening anymore by 1934. You're either part of a bigger revolutionary base area, or you're basically, you don't exist. So it's a much more concentrated, centralized organization. There will obviously still be contention for leadership over the party. Mao will still have to fend off several other contenders for power. But the idea that there are now only relatively small number of potential leaders, that's pretty clear. Discipline. One thing that torturing people does is make them answer questions a lot faster. I think that one of the things that this hunt for so-called AB clique people did was, make people fight harder. If you don't fight harder, you're suspect. So you're bringing a sort of hierarchical discipline to a society, rural China at that time. You just don't have that sort of hierarchical discipline that you came out of this. So by 1934, this is a very different party. It's much more hierarchical, much more disciplined, fewer contenders for leadership, much more disciplined, I guess. I didn't list that one. So it's a really quite different party. And this is probably the party that we know expanding from the Yan'an years onward.
Mm, yeah, those are some pretty big changes. And definitely things that, as I sort of hinted at in the beginning, are aspects of the CCP that we may be more familiar with as it goes later on and don't necessarily know where that came from. So I think in that sense, your book is really helpful in sort of excavating the origins of stuff that we might be used to.
Well, that's what I'm trying to do, yes.
Well, good, because that's what, as a reader, it seemed like you were doing. So now that we've kind of covered the main ground of your book, obviously not in nearly as much detail as the book itself, I'd love to ask you a little bit about the kind of process of writing it, the behind the scenes, as it were. And in particular, I was wondering if you'd be able to talk a little bit about how you did research for this book, given that there are a number of things that seem, at least from the outside, to be like challenges. First of all, this was a long time ago. This is a history that's not particularly well known. So accessing, obviously everyone's dead, so you can't go interview people. Accessing the documents, you know, what kinds of documents were there? And also, given the political sensitivity of the history of the CCP, obviously they're still the political party in power in China. Did that impact your research process at all?
No, not much. I'm a pretty independent guy. I think that everybody who goes back to this period reads a book written by a man by the name of Dai Xiangqing, and his wife. And that's the one that really blows up the myth that there was an AB group there. I can't remember the year that was published off the top of my head, but it wasn't that long ago. And so this is the sort of the first really comprehensive effort to go through the data. And Dai Xiangqing was a very diligent researcher. And, you know, that's really the basis of the starting point for studying this period. There are lots of documents that have been published in a earlier period, usually in the early to mid 80s, that the trouble with reading documents by themselves is you don't have the context. And, you know, you have to go through and figure out what the context is. And that just requires reading things like the Dai Xiangqing book, reading other documents, talking to scholars who have studied this period and at least know the general outlines. The specifics are tend to elude even specialists. I think that over the last decade or so, there have been efforts to celebrate the history of Donggu, because this really was forgotten history. It was forgotten because it's really embarrassing. The Futian incident is a real black mark on the history of the Chinese Communist Party. And so you can't really, until the 80s or 90s, you just didn't even know about this. The name Li Wenlin is erased from one of Mao Zedong's famous letters to Lin Biao, a military commander. So this was an extremely sensitive part of party history, and I think that it's become less sensitive simply because time has gone by, and there are people who want to try to recover the real face of the revolution. There have been a number of scholars in China that have studied parts of this, and you know, I think that they have written in and around the incident. I don't think that they're allowed yet to pull things together the way I have tried to do in this book. I expect this will eventually this all of this is going to come out, and probably in a much better, more complete, comprehensive way than I as an outsider can do. But yes, you're right. It is difficult to study. The data is very scattered, and you just have to rely on reading hundreds and hundreds of pages of documents, talking to people, scholarship that's available.
Well, in those hundreds and hundreds of pages of documents and conversations, was there anything in particular, maybe even something that didn't make it into the book, that particularly surprised you?
I mean, this whole insider-outsider division was something that I had not expected to find. The idea that that peasants really don't want to join the revolution is a surprise. The role of Li Wenlin in leading the Donggu revolutionary movement, it's really surprising. And how he fought with Mao. I mean, they go to meetings and they really fight with each other verbally. I'd always thought of the luring the enemy in deep as this great invention of Mao Zedong and one of the secrets to his guerrilla warfare, without thinking about how many local people are going to get killed in this. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the part of the story, after the Futian incident, the Kuomintang and the so-called first extermination campaign goes right through Donggu. And the Kuomintang general spends 3 days burning and killing. So Li Wenlin was right that this strategy was going to be devastating for the local area. But then he pushed too far, and the communist armies, Mao's army, was able to defeat his army, which paid no attention to to support from other military forces. And they killed the Kuomintang general and actually decapitated him and nailed his head to a board and sent it down the Gan River back to Nanchang. So in that sense, I suppose you'd have to say Mao was right that luring the enemy in deep did give them an advantage of understanding the local geography and, mobility, the ability to apply guerrilla tactics. But I think one of the things that this surprises you is just the incredible violence in this period. I think that by the end of the Central Soviet area, probably something north of 70,000 people had been executed as suspected members of the AB group, and at least 70% of those were members of the Chinese Communist Party. And I think that that's one of the reasons, just one of the reasons why the Chinese Communist Party had to leave Jiangxi and embark on the Long March.
Hmm. Yep. Okay. I'm glad I'm not the only one who is surprised. I certainly had heard the name Donggu, but had never thought of the insider-outsider aspect, and found that really added a lot of layers to kind of understanding that period that is often sort of murky and kind of like a greatest hits, like the United Front broke down, everyone fled, and then we somehow now have Mao in charge and the Long March. And it's sort of like, okay, hang on a second. It's probably a lot more complicated than that. So thank you for looking through the hundreds of documents and helping us understand that. And so then for my final question, now that this book is published, what are you working on now or next?
I think when I finished this one, I was so exhausted. Drained. I haven't really landed on a new project yet, although I think I'm interested in sort of the origins of the Korean War and the Sino-Soviet relations, and more broadly in trying to better relate China's domestic politics to its foreign policy, something that seems to be quite relevant today, but I want to explore it historically.
Fascinating. Well, best of luck with that. But probably do take a break. This book has literally just come out.
Yes.
And while you go off and decide what your next project is, listeners can read the book we've just been discussing, which, as a reminder, is titled Forging Leninism in China, Mao and the Remaking of the Chinese Communist Party, 1927 to 1934, published just now in 2022 by Cambridge University Press. Dr. Joe Fewsmith, thank you very much for sharing your time and expertise with the podcast.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Melcher, for this very pleasant conversation.